To the third case, appeal number 043177, Lee Thompson versus the City of Chicago. Mr. Schwartz.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. My name is Randall Schwartz, and I represent the estate of James Thompson, Mr. Thompson's mother, and his widow. We had initially raised two issues or two types of issues on this appeal, but I believe the second one was addressed by this court in its Russ versus Watts decision that came down subsequent to the briefs. And unless the court has any questions on that issue, I'll refer all my remarks to the first evidentiary concerns. In this case, Your Honors, the district court erred in two areas of evidentiary rulings, the first dealing with purported expert testimony from an OPS investigator and a sergeant of training for the Chicago Police Department, and second, erred in failing to admit the general orders relative to the use of deadly force in place at the time of this incident. Dealing with the first issue, the OPS and Sergeant Campbell's testimony. Both those individuals who investigated or were involved in the investigation of this incident found that the officer, Bradley Hespy, had used excessive force and had violated the Chicago Police Department general orders. Though that testimony was not allowed to get to this jury.
Right. And are you aware of any cases that support your argument that that should have been kept out, that conclusion by the investigators? Any cases that support that? That is the conclusion that they made.
Well, there are a couple district court cases. One, the Todd case, and the other, I believe it's the Edwards case, that talk about the conclusions of investigative bodies. There are, on the other hand, other district court cases that say, no, we do not allow that conclusion in. But I believe the cases that do allow that conclusion in are more persuasive. First, you are dealing with a situation where the standard at issue in this case is the objective reasonableness of a police officer. What is better evidence than the same department's other police officers saying, no, what they did was objectively unreasonable? By limiting the testimony to those of the officers and prohibiting the testimony of investigators that come later who are also police officers.
But then you'd let the city define what's required under the Fourth Amendment.
It wouldn't be a one-for-one exchange. It would be evidence of the standard, the Fourth Amendment standard. As the Edwards case said, it is an evidence of objective reasonableness. It's evidence of the Fourth Amendment standard. It's not conclusive, and certainly any confusion that the jury might be tempted to engage in to say that, well, because they violated the Chicago Police Department general orders, they must have necessarily violated the Fourth Amendment, could have been dealt with and is dealt with in those cases that let this evidence in through a limiting instruction, stating exactly what I just did, which is that you can consider evidence of violations of the department's general orders as evidence of unreasonableness, although it's not conclusive on the issue. And so there would not be that kind of danger that defendants typically raise, which is, well, if we let the conclusion of OPS in, it will automatically lead the jury to determine that a Fourth Amendment violation occurred. However, by keeping that evidence from the jury is effectively left with the evidence or the testimony of the officers who testified, yes, we were reasonable, without any type of contradicting evidence, specifically with respect to two individuals that are experts in the Chicago Police Department use of force guidelines.
Well, as I understand the record, you can certainly correct me if I'm wrong, there was testimony in the record about when deadly force could be used, right?
Yes,
and
sir.
an explanation of, even though the exact standards, the guidelines that were distributed by the department did not go to the jury, there was certainly discussion of those guidelines. And though, as I understand that testimony, it accurately portrayed what was in the guidelines.
Yes, Your Honor.
So the jury did have that in terms of make. I understand they didn't have the ultimate conclusion, and they didn't have the actual black and white paper on the guidelines, but they had the testimony, which basically mirrored the guidelines.
Yes, Your Honor, but the question is a difference in quality as opposed to content of evidence. Yes, the jury did hear the words, but it's different. I mean, the only way they heard that was through an expert that the plaintiffs hired, who is subject to the litany of cross-examination that experts are subject to. So it was only out of his mouth that the jury heard what the standard was. Now, the jury is going to hear that evidence, and yes, when we look at the black and white record, we can see the words on the page. But it's important to also remember the context and the medium through which the content was conveyed.
Well, did the officers testify? And, you know, on the defense side, was there anybody from the department who testified?
We did call Sergeant Campbell. Sergeant Campbell was allowed to speak in a limited fashion as to the general parameters of the training that
so
officers...
So was he cross-examined on the use of deadly force, and did he corroborate the statement of the plaintiff's expert?
No.
Was
no,
he cross-examined on that?
I don't believe so. I don't... She was actually called in the plaintiff's case in chief.
As an adverse witness.
Yes, ma'am.
Right.
But it goes back to the how...
Well, I guess I'm trying to figure out, so then if the witness was called adversely, and then that witness could have brought out the testimony as well.
Yes, again. But what juries, I believe, look for is real, concrete evidence of a standard in any type of case.
But what difference does it make whether it comes in through the expert or through an officer on the department?
Well, the difference is in presentation. Here we have one, on one hand, I am a police officer in the Chicago Police Department, I am the head of training, and I say this is the rule. That comes across one way to a jury, as opposed to I, who am an expert, who haven't been a police officer.
How do you know he hasn't been?
Because that was brought out on cross-examination.
Well, I said, how do you know that it doesn't necessarily follow that an expert hasn't been a police officer?
That's true. But considering the method that the testimony comes in, it comes in through me. It comes in through an individual that I'm paying. It comes
but
in
also that individual should not be biased. He should be telling from his experience and from all of the cases that he has testified in, that in this case, this is a fact.
And that is true, but we have to look at what its effect is on the jury. The jury is going to perceive it differently depending upon who it comes from.
Or the jury is going to say, well, they had a reason to put this man down.
Exactly. I mean, the jury's...
It goes both ways.
It does, but what keeping the conclusion from the jury does is it creates a situation where evidence of reasonable conduct comes in through the officers at the scene, and that's it. Evidence of unreasonable conduct only comes in through somebody that a paid expert witness, and that may be all we are left with in a normal case, in a typical scenario. But here we have two individuals from the very department that's being challenged, two individuals that are, from the record, experts in the area of the Chicago Police Department general orders. They reviewed everything that experts review in this case, and they came to the conclusion that the officer in this case was unreasonable.
Because they want to get rid of him.
I'm sorry?
Because they want to get rid of him.
Well, you know, sadly, this officer is still there.
Right.
And some people...
See, it does play both ways.
It does, but... And I'm not even talking about getting into the discipline that may or may not have occurred to the officer in this case. Whether or not he was disciplined, whether or not he was suspended, I agree is irrelevant to the issues in this case. But two opinions of experts in the area who looked at the materials, who said, we know what the department's general orders are, and we know what a objectively reasonable Chicago police officer should do, have concluded that he was unreasonable. Now, again,
well, isn't a big problem that you face the standard that we have to apply? Because even if in the first instance, even if I would have let in the standard and not the conclusion by the officers, that's not really the test that we have to apply here. It's abuse of discretion. And as you indicated, there are a couple cases that have let all this in, but vast majority of the cases have not. And so, I mean, that's the big hurdle you have to overcome.
No question, Judge. And abuse of discretion, we all know, is a high standard, but discretion is not unbounded. Discretion cannot be whatever the district court decides is okay with us, because then what we have is an effectively unreviewable decision. If all we say here is it's up to the discretion of the trial judge and the standard is so high that we're not going to address it, what we have now made is an unreviewable evidentiary decision.
Well, no, it's reviewable because the district court grounded it in the Fourth Amendment and the idea that there might be confusion with respect to the jury as to what standard to apply. I mean, there was a rational basis for the... I understand you disagree, but the court gave a reason.
Well, and what I suggest is the reason the court made is not correct under the law. I mean, what we need... And now just addressing Your Honor's point about just the standard itself, putting aside the expert's final conclusion, the sergeant, the OPS's conclusion, the standard itself is a piece of evidence that must go to the jury. It is both with respect to the Fourth Amendment claim as well as the Illinois state law claims. The standard under the Fourth Amendment, as you know, is objective reasonableness. The piece of paper that defines how officers should and should not act is absolute evidence of that standard. Moreover, when it comes to the state law claims, willful and wanton conduct, which is conduct which is, if it's not intentional, it's a conscious disregard of a known risk. Again, that standard is evidence of the violation of the ultimate standard that we're asking the jury to decide. But when we take away the one piece of paper from the jury that they could sit, that they could look at, and that, quite frankly, they are looking for in their analysis, we deprive the plaintiff of a fair trial by depriving the plaintiff of the ability to say, this is the standard, or this is evidence of the standard of what's applicable to these officers. And any time you have you're talking about a standard of conduct in front of a jury, they're going to take testimony for what it's worth. But the important pieces of evidence are those that are written. The important pieces of evidence are those that the jury can look at and say, well, based on the testimony that I've heard, did they meet this? Did they not?
See, we're talking about reviewing what happened during this trial. And in reviewing whether there's an abuse of discretion in keeping something out or letting something in, whatever it might be, you have to keep in mind this: the big picture of this trial. And I think this was a difficult case for the plaintiffs. Difficult in that there's a bad car chase, a crash, a fighting with the officers resisting, a victim, a tragic victim, but he had all kinds of medical problems. And the police didn't shoot him. They didn't beat him with a baton or anything like that. It was a struggle to restrain him. It seems, looking at that, that's a difficult case to win, and to overturn it on this point, I think, is difficult. Somebody pulled out a gun and shot him 3-4 times. I mean, we don't need standards to say that is unreasonable. That's going to be excessive force. But in this case, it just seems sort of hard to conclude that even letting that in, as you suggest, would have made the outcome of the trial any different.
Well, I would suggest, Your Honor, the difficulty of the case is why the evidentiary issues are so important in this case. As you say, if you shoot somebody three times in the back, you don't need a standard to say that that's wrong. But here, where there is some vagary, where there is some dispute as to both what happened and what the rules were at the time, depriving the jury of the only piece of evidence that conclusively, or that the most powerful piece of evidence on the issue, was error, and the remedy is to remand this case, to allow this evidence before the jury, and to retry this matter. I see my time is up.
Yes, it is. Thank you. Ms. Pastor?
May it please the Court. To overturn the jury verdict in this case, the plaintiffs have to show not only that the district court's evidentiary rulings were an abuse of discretion, but that this abuse of discretion was more than simply harmless error, as Your Honor has pointed out this morning. In fact, they have done neither. This morning I will explain first why the district court's rulings excluding the police department general order and the expert testimony from the two police department investigators were not an abuse of discretion. And second, I will explain why even if these rulings had been an abuse of discretion, they were at worst harmless error and do not warrant a new trial.
Well, here we had a lay jury trying to make this determination, and there were standards that the police department had on deadly force. What would have been the harm of letting the jury at least know what the standards were? Why wasn't that relevant to their determination as to whether or not there was a Fourth Amendment violation? Let's take that separately from the conclusion that the department reached. Although we all know the conclusion was that he did use deadly force inappropriately. So we have that. We know what that is. We know why the court kept that out. But what in the first instance, why shouldn't the jury have been given, even though the expert testified to the standard, an actual copy of the document?
Your Honor, when the police department promulgates general orders, such as the general order on deadly force, it has myriad purposes in doing so. Compliance, ensuring that its officers comply with the Constitution, is only one of many purposes. There are issues of efficiency, public relations, trying to protect against litigation. So when the police department, composes these documents, they have all these purposes in mind. These documents do not, in fact, reflect constitutional standards. And so,
but there's just only one portion of the document that they wanted in. There's a few lines about use of deadly force. I understand there was a lot of other stuff on that. I looked at that. The guidelines, okay, none of that was relevant, but the portion they wanted was just that little narrow portion that talked about use of deadly force, and use of deadly force was appropriate or could be used.
But again, the Chicago Police Department sets a different standard, and when it wants its officers to use deadly force, it's okay for their officers to use deadly force than the Constitution does. Certainly, the Chicago Police Department wants, at minimum, the officers to comply with the Constitution, but it can restrict, and in fact does restrict, its officers more stringently than the Constitution.
So where in that definition that they give of deadly force is it more stringent than what the Fourth Amendment requires?
Well, Your Honor, it's a subtle distinction. I'll grant you that. But I've examined the Supreme Court's standard, and I've examined this standard, and I think that this standard is more strict. It certainly says that it intends to be more strict than state law permits.
And tell me, I want to know, to give me just specifically what the distinction is. That's what I want. I understand your conclusion is it's more strict. I want to know, what is it that leads you to make that conclusion?
Well, under the general order, the officer is only justified in using deadly force when he believes it's necessary to prevent death or great and necessary is the key word here, to prevent death or great bodily harm to himself or to another. The Fourth Amendment's reasonable standard allows for deadly force to be used when the officer has probable cause to believe that it's necessary. Actually, not necessary. I want to make that distinction.
We'll start at the beginning. I'm not tracking.
I apologize, Your Honor. It's my fault. The general order says you can only use deadly force when it's absolutely necessary to prevent death or great bodily harm to another. The Constitution says deadly force can be used when the officer has probable cause to believe that himself or another, or that suspect poses a serious threat of physical harm to himself or to another. I think the distinction here is the necessary. The Chicago Police Department says deadly force must be absolutely necessary to prevent great harm. I think the Constitution says, did you have probable cause to believe that this suspect posed a risk of great harm? In that case, you can use deadly force.
And that particular definition you've given was what the court tracked for the jury instructions. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor. Absolutely. There was no error there. You know, in terms of a Fourth Amendment analysis, this court has cautioned many times that, you know, we can't judge the officer's actions in a rapidly evolving situation with the 20/20 hindsight of the courtroom. So the Constitution, I think, again, has one standard, and the Chicago Police Department prefers to hold its officers to a higher standard for many reasons. And again, so the danger then in introducing this document is the confusion to the jury, which is what the district court concluded. And that's clearly not an abuse of discretion. For a lay jury to comprehend that the Constitution has one standard, the Chicago Police Department has another standard, the officer may have violated the police department standards without violating the Constitution, is confusing, I think, as the district court properly concluded. The expert testimony that the plaintiff sought to introduce suffered from the same defects. These witnesses purported to opine solely on whether Officer Hespe used excessive force under Chicago Police Department standards. But as we explained, these standards are not the same as constitutional standards, nor are they the same as state law standards. In fact, the Illinois Appellate Court has spoken to this issue quite specifically in the Morton case by saying that evidence of violation of a general order is not the same, is not proof of evidence of willful and wanton conduct. Therefore, this expert testimony also presented a serious risk of confusing or misleading the jury. But, of course, even if this evidence had been improperly excluded, Your Honors, there is simply no basis for ordering a new trial here. First, as has been discussed this morning, there was ample evidence adduced at trial from Sergeant Campbell's and Dr. Alpert, the expert's testimony, that if Officer Hespe had, in fact, used a chokehold on Mr. Thompson, that would have violated police department rules and it would have constituted excessive force. I feel compelled just briefly to mention Sergeant Campbell's testimony. Sergeant Campbell spoke in hypotheticals, but these hypotheticals were certainly very plain. She spoke about the Chicago Police Department's use of force paradigm, what kinds of force is appropriate with what kind of assailant. She was also asked questions about, well, hypothetically, if someone were doing X, Y, and Z being what Mr. Thompson was alleged to have done on the night in question, what kind of assailant would he have been, what kind of force would have been appropriate. And she answered those questions, again, in the hypotheticals, but it doesn't take much to see what the point behind all those hypotheticals were, and it was clearly to discuss the situation at hand.
I just have one follow-up hypothetical on the distinction you made between the city's regulations and the constitutional definition of deadly force or use of deadly force. Do you think a jury instruction would have been adequate if that had been admitted, explaining the distinction? In other words, could it come in a limited fashion?
Well, again, Your Honor, I think that potentially introduces yet a third level of confusion. This idea that the police department has this standard, the Constitution has another standard, you can consider and then to give an instruction to the jury, well, you may consider the police department standard, but only for this limited purpose. I think that injects even another level of confusion. And these truly, whether or not to issue a limiting instruction or whether or not to exclude the evidence altogether, these are the kinds of decisions that are traditionally left to the sound discretion of the trial court. As you pointed out, the district courts and the circuit have gone both ways on this issue. And in those cases, it's nearly impossible to conclude that the discretion was abused. But even with all the testimony that was adduced at the trial about the police department regulations on the use of force, the jury still returned a verdict for Officer Hespe in this case. And this is really not surprising. The evidence in this case, as Your Honor, Judge Evans pointed out, is not even close. There was simply no physical evidence of any kind that Officer Hespe had used a chokehold on Mr. Thompson, and there was overwhelming evidence that Mr. Thompson's death was caused by his serious medical problems, his heart disease, coupled with his drug use and the stress of fleeing from the officers on the night in question. Given this, it's impossible to conclude that the excluded evidence would have any effect on the jury's verdict in this case. If there are no further questions, we would simply ask that the judgment of the district court be affirmed.
Thank you. Your time has expired. We'll take this case under advisement. Thank you to both counsel for an excellent presentation.